ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। We're reading from the fifth canto, chapter 18, text 19. Just read the English. Okay. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Translation. My dear Lord, you are certainly the fully independent master of all the senses. Therefore, all women who worship you, by strictly observing vows because they wish to acquire a husband to satisfy their senses, are surely under illusion. They do not know that such a husband cannot actually give protection to them or their children, nor can he protect their wealth or duration of life, for he himself is dependent on time, fruitive results, and the modes of nature, which are all subordinate to you. Purport. In this verse, Lakshmidevi, Rama, shows compassion toward women who worship the Lord for the benediction of possessing a good husband. Although such women desire to be happy with children, wealth, a long duration of life, and everything dear to them, they cannot possibly do so. In the material world, a so-called husband is dependent on the control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There are many examples of a woman whose husband, being dependent on the result of his own fruitive actions, cannot maintain his wife, her children, her wealth, or her duration of life. Therefore, factually, the only real husband of all women is Krishna, the Supreme Husband. Because the gopis were liberated souls, they understood this fact. Therefore, they rejected their material husbands and accepted Krishna as their real husband. Krishna is the real husband not only of the gopis, but of every living entity. Everyone should perfectly understand that Krishna is the real husband of all living entities who are described in the Bhagavad Gita as Prakriti, female, not Purusha, male. In Bhagavad Gita 10.12, only Krishna is addressed as Purusha. Paramam padam brahma padam dhamma pavitam padamam bhavam purusham shash Vatam Divyam Adidevam Ajam Vibhum. You are the Supreme Brahman, the ultimate, the supreme abode and purifier, the absolute truth and the eternal divine person. You are the primal God, transcendental and original, and you are the unborn and all-pervading beauty. Krishna is the original Purusha, and the living entities are Prakriti. Thus Krishna is the enjoyer, and all living entities are meant to be enjoyed by him. Therefore, any woman who seeks a material husband for her protection, or any man who desires to become the husband of a woman, is under illusion. To become a husband means to maintain a wife and children nicely by supplying wealth and security. However, a material husband cannot possibly do this, for he is dependent on his karma. Karma deva netvena. His circumstances are determined by his past fruitive activities. Therefore, if one proudly thinks he can protect his wife, he is under illusion. Krishna is the only husband, and therefore the relationship between the husband and wife in this material world cannot be absolute. Because we have the desire to marry, Krishna mercifully allows a so-called husband to possess a wife, and the wife to possess a so-called husband, for mutual satisfaction. In the Ishapanishad, it is said, Tena taktena bhunjita. The Lord provides everyone with his quota. Actually, however, every living entity is Prakriti or female, and Krishna is the only husband. Krishna is the original master of or husband of everyone. And all other living entities, having taken the form of so-called husbands or wives, are dancing according to his desire. A so-called husband may unite with his wife for sense gratification, but his senses are conducted by Rishikesha, the master of the senses, who is therefore the actual husband. Again, Hare Krishna. So first, of course, I would like to beg for the blessings of all the assembled Vaishnavas who from the very beginning of my own spiritual life have been my guides and inspirations. I can proudly say, this was the first temple that I actually joined, even though I live in New York. Many times, devotees in the West, they'll see me, if I'm with Maharaj, they'll say, are you from Chaupati? And sometimes I have to think twice. So, deeply, I would like to say, yes, I am from Chaupati. But then I don't claim to be because I know I can't perfectly represent all of you. So I give a full explanation saying that, well, I did join there, but only for a few months. So they understand that if I misrepresent all of you, that I'm actually not from there. I'm just some kind of a false representative. So I beg for the blessings of all my senior God brothers who have given me such tremendous inspiration for the last 6-7 years of my spiritual life, and who are also very intimidating to look at when I sit up here. This is probably one of my biggest fears. But anyways, with their blessings, I'm sure I'll achieve some kind of purification in whatever shape or form it may come. So this is a wonderful verse in which Lakshmi Devi is very nicely explaining, is glorifying the Lord, actually. She's glorifying the Lord, telling him that, my Lord, you are the supreme independent controller. And simultaneously, she's telling us what our position in life is, how much under illusion we are, that we're finding so many things in this material world to place faith in, to depend on for protection. And what is she saying? That those who think in this way are surely under illusion. Of course, she's specifically talking about women who are trying to depend on their husbands for protection. But Prabhupada very nicely clarifies that actually we're all just energy, prakriti. There's only one enjoyer, and that's Krishna. So from our very beginning of our lives, we're trained actually in this amazingly false conception. We ride the wave of this illusion. During the South India Yatra, we rode many waves on the beaches, all different beaches. So like this, we're riding so many waves of false conceptions, one after another. From the very birth, we're taught to depend on our parents for protection, understanding that they'll care for us, they'll protect us. As we get older, we develop friendships, and then we naturally depend on our friends for some kind of moral support, financial support, and other types of support. Then as we get older, enter the working field, protection naturally goes towards the boss, then slowly the country. And then, of course, what Prabhupada is talking about here and what Lakshmi Devi is talking about, the relationship between husband and wife. There's so much dependence and interdependence that we create. Now, of course, we're not so fanatic. We are definitely somewhat fanatic, but not so fanatic as to deny that in human relationships, there has to be dependence. We do depend on a lot of things. But it's just that the way that we're trained, that we're educated by society, there's an imbalance in that dependence. The way we're taught to depend, it's an imbalance. Because we're only taught to depend on material things, material facilities, material relationships. That's the only, so the scale is tipped. And that's an unhealthy balance. So dependence is not wrong because Jivera Swarupoi, Krishnera Nitya Das, we know that the living entity, the constitutional position of the living entity is to just always depend. We're in a position of servitude, whether we like it or not. We're always in a position of servitude, of dependence. So that dependence is naturally going to be there. It's always going to be there. And it'll actually never leave us, no matter how hard we try to leave it. It's just impossible. Just like the inherent quality of sugar is sweetness. So one of the qualities of the soul is just to depend. We are so dependent for our existence, for day-to-day maintenance. We're depending on God and so many other things. So that dependence is natural. And artificially, if we renounce our dependence on our friends or family, then that can be unhealthy for our own spiritual lives. Because it'll help develop a very fanatic, unhealthy attitude, mood within us towards the material world. So our goal isn't to hate the material world or just to reject everything. Our goal, our process, is to use everything in Krishna's service, even the material world. However we can, in whatever way we can, under the guidance of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, our goal is to utilize everything in the service of God. The Bhagavatam tells us that in this day and age, men are very lazy, right? They're very quarrelsome, they're very misguided, and therefore they're always very disturbed. And another thing it says, that men in this age are over-dependent on another's mercy. We become so over-dependent on another person, thinking that my boss will maintain me, that how am I going to survive if this person isn't there, or this situation isn't there, or this circumstance isn't there. So this creates a very fearful situation for the living being. All throughout our lives, we go live in a very fearful situation. Always over-dependent on so many other things and so many other people. What if this happens? What if that happens? And therefore, we can see just the world and insurance companies and so many other companies are taking such wonderful advantage of this. It's an industry based on fear. Because we're so feeling a need for protection from other sources other than God, we have to take so many other measures. And again, it's not that we artificially reject these things, but we need to have a healthy balance in our lives so that we can slowly learn to depend on God, and ultimately, by the end of our lives, that we can become fully dependent on God. Krishna is trying very hard and speaking very emphatically in the Bhagavad Gita, telling us to not fear. Right? He's telling us, Sarva Dharman Prityagya, Mam Ikam Sharanam Vraja, Aham Tvam Sarva Papebhyo, Moksha Ishami, Masuchaha. Krishna knows our condition. Krishna knows that we're always in a very fearful situation. We're always very scared, uncertain of what's going to happen. So Krishna's trying to appease our mind. He's telling us, do not fear. I'm here. I'm going to protect you. But before he makes this conclusive statement in the Bhagavad Gita, before this, he makes so many other statements trying to help us establish faith in him. The whole purpose of the Bhagavad Gita really is to help us develop faith in Krishna. And that's what he's doing throughout the first 17 chapters. And finally he says, now you shouldn't have any reason to fear. Just surrender unto me. Right from the very beginning, he's saying that so many lives we have both passed. I can remember them all, but you cannot, Arjuna. I'm the source of all spiritual material worlds. Everything comes from me. The wise who know this, surrender unto me and worship me. He says, everything rests on me as pearls rest on a thread. From me comes knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. I am the super soul in all living beings. I am the sun, I am the moon. I am the ability in man. So many powerful statements he's making. Just as a foundation for this one statement that he's making now. That, do not fear. I will protect you, and I will deliver you from all sinful reactions. So, the Bhagavad Gita is actually at least meant to help us come to this level. And Krishna is also saying, I'm beyond the three modes of nature. Because that could be another valid question that somebody can ask. That I'm under the modes, but no, Krishna is establishing that he's not, he creates the material energy, but he's not influenced or illusioned by it. So he's saying all of these things to help dispel our illusion. But still, it's very difficult for us. It's difficult for us to do this. And we can see Krishna, how he manifests his mercy to help us develop that faith. Of course, we understand that just through some sukriti, some pious credit, maybe perhaps we did some service for a devotee at some point in our lives, that help us come in contact with devotees. We came into Sadhu Sangha. And in that Sadhu Sangha, we find that devotional service begins somehow or other by the mercy of the devotees. And in our early stages, we find surrender to be actually quite easy. We see it to be quite easy. So we're dancing along, singing along. Just like Prabhupada said, all we're doing is chanting, dancing, and feasting. And in the beginning days, that's exactly our realization. Later on, his disciples said, but Prabhupada, there's so many other things we have to worry about and so many difficulties we're facing. He's saying, no, we're just chanting, dancing, and feasting. So that's an advanced realization, what Prabhupada had. But we have that same realization when we first come into Krishna consciousness. We're just chanting, dancing, and feasting. The kirtans are ecstatic. The classes are ecstatic. Right? The prasadam is, of course, the most ecstatic. But then, as we're riding this wonderful wave of sadhu sangha and bhajana kriya, gradually we come across the mountainous, like we were swimming in this one ocean. This is Kanyakumari. There were so many rocks in that ocean. First, from a distance, it looked so attractive, so beautiful, right? And then when you started to go in, you saw all these rocks everywhere. So you became a little cautious, a little scared, a little apprehensive. You know, are the waves going to thrash me around? Am I going to smash my head against a rock? So similarly, we ride this wave. And then, as we're riding this wave, we come face to face with the mountain of Anartha Nivritti. And then, here actually is when surrender starts. This is actually when surrender starts for the practicing devotee. And those who don't want to surrender will stop at this stage. They may say, it was fun up until now, but I think I'm going to stop right here. I'm not ready to climb this mountain. Because it is a mountain, there's no doubt, right? It's a unmovable mountain, right? It's huge. It can be very frightening. Just like when we were about to climb the stairs of the Tirumala Hills. Initially, at least my mind was thinking, 4 hours. And Maharaj had prepped us early, saying, in some places it's very steep. So that part of the lecture kept coming back in my mind as I was climbing the steps. Yeah, I guess this is the steep part right here that he was talking about. So as we start climbing, it can be very frightening. It can be very overwhelming. And here really is when surrender begins for the devotees. If we want to overcome this false conception of who is the real proprietor and who is the real enjoyer and who really we should surrender to, then there's no choice. We have to start the trek up the hill of Anartha Nivritti. There is no other choice. Really, there isn't. And it's actually a wonderful opportunity for us to show Krishna that, Krishna, now I'm going to start surrendering. Because there's so many people that will come for the chanting and dancing and feasting. And sometimes you'll see devotees that will come. 5, 10 years can go by, and they're still chanting, dancing, and feasting, but they have not internally made the choice to start the climb of that mountain of Anartha Nivritti. And we're not judging such devotees, because that's just where they may be in their spiritual lives, and internally we don't know. They may be liberated souls. We just don't know in this assembly of devotees who's who. We could be sitting amongst perfectly liberated souls and who appear to be not doing what we expect to be, what we understand as sadhana bhakti. So of course, simultaneously as we practice sadhana bhakti and climb this mountain, we learn simultaneously not to judge others. Because in the Bible it says, if you judge others, then you can also expect to be judged at the time of judgment. No, as you sow, so shall you reap. It's not a one-way street. It goes two ways. So surrender for us starts with that third stage of Anartha Nivritti. Before, it's a smooth ride, and after, it's also a pretty smooth ride. But this one section is the big hump that we're worried about. And there's different ways we can approach it. Because sadhu sangha is the foundation of all these nine stages of progress. That stage stays with us from the beginning to end. We never abandon that stage because it's the sadhus that bring us into association of other sadhus. It's the sadhus that engage us in devotional service, teach us how to perform devotional service. And it's these same sadhus who are going to help us climb this mountain of anartha nivritti. Because during the climb, there's going to be many opportunities where we may slip, we may scratch ourselves, we may hurt ourselves, may even be faced with serious injuries. So therefore, our process is not a process of isolating ourselves and in some immature state thinking that we can achieve self-realization on our own. Our process is that we, with the association of devotees, with the help of the devotees, we make advancement and we slowly trek this climb. We start this climb. And this requires humility because in a humble state of mind, we have to understand that the only way we're climbing, making this climb, is through the association of the devotees. It is they who are helping us climb this mountain. I'm not climbing it on my own, even though it may seem like it at times. No, it is they who are helping me cross over. If in this mood we make the trek, then we'll cross over. Otherwise, if we think that I'm strong enough, if we're stuck in the phase of utsaha mai, false enthusiasm, for too long, then what we're doing as we're climbing this mountain, or we think we're climbing this, we're creating a mountain of false pride. And we're just kind of climbing that, thinking, yeah, look at me, I'm making progress now. Look at me go. I'm running faster than everybody else. Everyone else is behind me. So we're actually created a whole other mountain if we don't surrender to the devotees, which is what it's being talked about here, is surrender to the devotees. So as we surrender to the devotees, and that's the wonderful thing about devotional service, from beginning to end requires surrender. And of course, we can see that's where the wonderful example of Bharata Maharaj comes in. He was on the stage of bhava. Practically, realistically, there's no possibility of falling down from that stage. It's just impossible. Because even the stage before that, it's explained that one's consciousness, meditation on Krishna, is so thick that it's difficult to get any other thoughts other than Krishna in there, in your consciousness. It's practically impossible to think of anything else. And bhava comes after that. I even asked Reverend Dasruprabhu one time, that is it possible for a function, for a purpose, for a person on this level to function in society? Because in the stage of ashakti, it's like addiction. You're trying to do other things, but your mind just wanders towards Krishna. You just can't help it. It's like an addiction. An addicted person can't stop thinking of the object that they want to enjoy. It's an addiction. So I asked Reverend Dasruprabhu, I said, is it possible for this kind of a person to function in society? He said, it's actually very difficult. For them, it's actually quite difficult. But the very advanced devotees can repress that just to function and to guide others. So Bharat Maharaj, the only reason that example's there is just to show us that he wasn't in the association of devotees. That's what we can learn from. It's a very important thing that we can learn from, because our whole process is sadhu sangha. That is our whole process. So even though he was on such a high platform, such a high bhava, right? Ecstatic ecstasies he was experiencing. But because he was on his own, no God brothers, no God family, no devotees to guide, to give a warning that, you know, what you did for this deer might have been nice, but you better let it go. Now it's the time to let it go. Enough compassion on that platform, but now let it go. There was no one there. So we can see that sadhu sangha really, that's the underlying foundation of our whole process of devotional service. If at any point we think that we can avoid sadhu sangha and make advancement on our own, then that's definitely a sign that Maya has made a hole into our consciousness and planted a seed there. Because for a lot of us, growing up in this day and age, we have a certain impersonalistic mood. We kind of like to do our own thing. I like to do my own thing in my own way. But in devotional service, we learn only dependence. We learn to depend on others. And that dependence is really what pleases Krishna. So, as we're climbing this mountain, it's really interesting because as you climb a mountain sometimes, as you get a little bit further, you see there's other peaks. First, you just see the initial mountain. As you go further, then you see other obstacles, boulders that you may have to climb over. Other things become manifest. And so there's many so this basically represents different types of challenges that will come. The biggest challenge, of course, is our anarthas, but our anarthas manifest in so many different ways, gross ways and subtle ways. There's many different things that will be tested. One of the things, of course, is as we progress in devotional life, the same devotees who've been helping us, if gradually what may happen is, because of our conditioned nature, those same devotees we start finding faults with. That, okay, I've been, in the first couple of years, I needed this, I understood what this devotee was saying, but now, I already know this. Why are they correcting? Why do they feel a need to correct me? So this, in the association of devotees, is probably going to be one of our biggest challenges. To cross this hurdle, thinking, because as we progress, it's natural for a certain pride. As we water that bhakti lata bij by hearing and chanting, and as the creeper is growing, simultaneously, if we're not very, very careful, this creeper of false pride just kind of comes along. And at some point, you may not even be able to recognize the actual creeper from this false creeper, false pride. So our anarthas will manifest in many ways. A very common way it manifests is when we think we know it all or we've learned enough. And when corrections of other devotees become painful for the false ego, or we resist, or we rebel in some way. That's really where that's going to be our biggest challenge. Facing the corrections of superiors or even equals, and sometimes even juniors. That's the really wonderful process of devotional service, because it'll happen. You can't avoid it. Someone or other is going to come up to you and correct you for something out of either not knowing or somebody who's senior who may correct you. The correction may come at appropriate time or inappropriate time. But whatever it may be, there is no lack of opportunity to surrender in Krishna consciousness. Krishna will give us unlimited opportunities to surrender. On a day-to-day basis, he'll give us so many opportunities to surrender. And usually, from at least in my own personal experience, those opportunities to surrender don't come when I'm on my own. If I make a mistake, no one sees it, no problem, I cover it up, I move on. False ego, no big deal. I can preach to myself and be happy. But when you make mistakes in front of others, or when others challenge your conception, challenge your thoughts, challenge your way of doing things, because after some time you've figured things out and someone else says, no, do it this way. So that false pride is the biggest thing that we're going to have to deal with. And the wonderful thing is about staying in the association of devotees, that mountain of false pride, that's the only way it really becomes purified. That's the only way really it becomes purified is in the association of devotees. It doesn't really get purified if you're on your own and doing your own thing and no one can ever challenge your conceptions or correct you in what you're doing. So if it's the more painful it is for us to receive a correction from somebody, we should understand that that's the degree of my false ego. If it's painful, no matter who it is actually, whether even if it's a junior who's not supposed to do it, But if it becomes painful to the false ego, that means I have a false ego and it's hurting. If it's not, that means there's no false ego. So the fact that it hurts, it's not whether or not that devotee transgressed Vaishnava etiquette. That's a separate story. That's for that devotee to deal with Krishna. Krishna will deal with that devotee. But your problem or our problem becomes that it hurt me. And because it hurt, that means I had a false ego that could be hurt. Because let's look at the lives of famous great saints. Jesus Christ, Prahlad Maharaj, Haridas Thakur. Huh? These are the famous, famous examples. Draupadi, what a famous example. Even though Ashwatthama beheaded her children in her sleep, in their sleep, what was her response? Oh, let's forgive him because I don't want his mother to suffer what I'm going through. That's painful. If someone, you know, even during the yatras, there's so many people, someone bumps you, steps on your foot, you get a little angry, right? Someone gets in front of you, in front of the line in prasadam, when you're hungry, you get a little upset, right? When you probably just did that the day before, right? Or if somebody pushes you and you get hurt in some way, what to speak of? What usually, a lot of times, our near and dear ones can sometimes be more dear to us than our own body. And for a mother, there's nothing more dear than a child. Nothing more dear. What to speak of a male child, right? In India, a male child is something that's very, very coveted. Anywhere, I guess, a male child is coveted. Carries on the family name. What to speak of five children, all young. And he slaughtered them, not even in a fair fight. He slaughtered them. And she's a supreme example of forgiveness. She was able to let go. No false ego. Because if you have a false ego, then all you think about is that I need to be satisfied. I need to be avenged now for this sin that was committed. There needs to be justice. And even if they would have killed him, it would have been okay. He transgressed so many etiquettes, right? So many codes of conduct. But this is, of course, done to glorify her. Haridas Thakur is praying for the people who are beating him. As they're beating him, he's praying. While the beating is going on, he's praying simultaneously. Same thing with Jesus Christ. As they're pounding nails into his wrists and feet, at that moment he's offering prayers. Because that's compassion. There's no false ego. So, why are these extreme examples there? They have to be extreme. Sometimes you can say, oh, well, I don't believe this. It's not possible. Well, that's our choice. Even Krishna at the end of the Gita says, well, Arjuna, I've told you everything. Now it's up to you, whatever you want to do. You can choose, take it or accept it. Hurry, bo. The fight's going to go on. The life's going to move on, but now you have a choice. So, it's so important for us to acknowledge and be ready to face our false egos. And each time we surrender and humbly accept an interaction that didn't go the way we want it to, we accept it, the correction, the chastisement, or whatever it may be, at that moment we've removed a tiny bit of that false ego. If we haven't, then we stayed exactly where we were before. We haven't really moved forward. Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj would say that every time you see me, I should have become a better person. Every next time you meet me, I should have improved. I should become a better human being. And that becomes our goal. So there's two ways to see it. One is we could be scared or just get discouraged about the fight, because very soon we start realizing that I have a huge false ego. Every little thing bothers me about everybody. And that can be very frightening. And if we're honestly willing to face our false ego, then we'll recognize it and we'll make progress. So there's two ways to deal with it. Either just become frightened and discouraged because it's such an overwhelming task. the other way to deal with it is with a nice fighting spirit. We can also have a fighting spirit. Yes, Krishna, keep sending these challenges. Send them more and more, because I want to get it over with. Let it come. Let it come. And please, give me the strength to deal with it in a healthy way. Give me the knowledge. Give me the humility to accept all the things that the devotees may say or do to me. Or the outside world, whoever. So if we have that fighting spirit, then devotional service becomes ecstatic. Then it's ecstatic. Because sometimes a situation will come and we react negatively. But if we're honest with ourselves, sometime later we'll recognize, oh, I blew it. Krishna sent a great test and I completely blew it. I failed. Okay. Krishna, please, I'm ready. Hopefully, I'll do better next time. From what I've seen is that the time of recognition decreases. Something happens, you fail. Sometimes it may take you weeks to figure out, wow, I really blew it a couple weeks ago. Sometime later, if you're honest and really looking to make advancement, maybe within a day you say, oh gosh, earlier this happened and I really blew it with this devotee. I should ask for forgiveness. And sometimes, eventually, right in the heat of the moment, you can say, it's a test, it's very painful, and I have an opportunity to take the humble role, but I don't do it. Okay, at least you're getting close. Then eventually, by the mercy of the devotees, by the mercy of Krishna, if you've been fighting and honestly begging forgiveness and taking humble positions, then in the heat of the moment, what will happen is you'll be able to swallow your false pride and just take whatever's coming in a very healthy spirit. And if we can do that, we'll instantly feel a certain, like we've taken a bath, a purification taking place. So this happens if all throughout our lives, as Krishna sends tests, sends these opportunities for us to surrender, that if we make endeavors to surrender. And surrender also means that, and again, it all happens in the association of devotees. If you're on your own, not interacting with devotees much, then the false ego basically stays, it stays the same, or the progress is, because the whole process is purifying us, but the purificatory process is a little slower. Because ultimately, we really want to destroy the false ego. False ego means that that it's painful when I interact with another false ego. So that means interaction is required for the removal of the false ego. So the association of the devotees, we've heard this so many times, is the most valuable and precious thing that we have. And sometimes when we're very closely associating with devotees, challenges come up. But through knowledge and intelligence, we should understand that this is my saving grace. This really is my saving grace. Because in the association of devotees, we will be forced to become humble. We won't have any other choice. We really won't have any other choice. And the ideal association of devotees is that in which we're surrounded by seniors, juniors, and equals. That is ideal. If these different levels of association are present, then we can be sure that Krishna will sufficiently purify us. There's no doubt. We will get sufficient purification from all sides. The false ego will get pounded when you least expect it. But that really is our saving grace. And hopefully we can come to a point where after or during such a moment of where we're dealing with purification, we express gratitude. That's a very high level, of course. Like the wonderful example of Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj. Through so much difficulty, he was expressing gratitude. He was grateful. It's a very high level. Easy to speak about, very difficult to act upon. Can't be acted upon falsely either. It has to come through deep realization. There's no way. Most of us, I can honestly say, I don't think I have the courage to pray like Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj did. I can't do it. There's no way. Seeing what he was going through, said, I had to admit, God, there's no way I can offer that same prayer right now. I'm not at that level. I would be frightened out of my mind to say what he said in front of the deities. Couldn't do it. Hope, though, someday, by his mercy and the mercy of all the devotees, we can actually pray like that. He was grateful the whole time. And how do we know he was grateful? Even throughout all of his suffering, he was always giving encouragement to others. Because devotees would come to him. Everybody came to see him. Devotees came to him who had lost faith in the process of devotional service, who had gone astray for many years. And yet, during time of intense physical pain, he would speak words of encouragement to them. He actually was able to reestablish faith in those who had lost their faith, replanted that seed of devotional service to such a degree that people were crying and weeping and were re-inspired to come back into the association of devotees. And he was in so much pain that no matter how much, even after they gave so much anesthesia, there was a certain times when his body would just shiver in pain, literally shiver, just shiver, tremble out of just pain. And we've heard Maharaj talk about his response to that. He would say, it just can't get any better than this. And yet, it's getting better. How does one say these things? You cannot falsely make these statements. So, and he was always encouraging others. He was always encouraging others. In all these difficult situations. I remember one time, after he and Radha Maharaj finished a session where they were sitting in the living room and talking, and sometimes they would bring him out into the living room because he wanted to come out of his rooms. He would come out into the living room. And so Radha Maharaj went down to use the bathroom, and Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj called me over. I was so happy and so shocked and so surprised. And he was encouraging me. He said, you're so fortunate to be doing the service that you're doing. You're so fortunate to be doing what you're doing. And I just said, thank you, Maharaj. Please bless me that I can keep doing it like this. And at every moment that he got an opportunity to encourage another, to express gratitude, he did it. Because we know what the tendency is, that once we have bodily discomfort, we become very self-absorbed. Right? It's difficult to think about anything else or anyone else because the body's in pain and I'm uncomfortable and just I, me, mine. It really you become self-absorbed. If the body gets an injury, just really meditating on this injury, then nothing else matters. But we could see how he was able to transcend that in a very high level and able to not only express gratitude for what was happening, but even higher, encourage others in the time of his pain. So there's so many levels of recognizing our anarthas and dealing with the false ego. But he demonstrated really for us the highest level of surrender to God. So we can pray that we can also someday come out of this illusion and stop placing our hopes in false masters of this world and really someday come to this level where we can truly place all faith and all shelter at the feet of our spiritual master, at the feet of the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna. So thank you very much. If there's any comments or corrections, I'll be very, very happy to receive them. Granthraj, Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, one question, comment.
If you could elaborate on one point regarding Draupadi, I'm not sure whether I understood the pastime correctly, but in the case of Dushasana, who untied her hair, she vowed that she would never put it together till she washes it with his blood.
Hmm.
And then Bhima said, yes, I'll bring him and rip his heart apart and then you can wash the hair. And they did it. So how would you put that pastime together with killing her five sons and her compassion over Ashwatthama?
It's a good and difficult question. My knowledge of Mahabharata is not so good, but I know that I think Bhima had also made certain vows, right, to kill the sons of Dhritarashtra. And so that vow, so it's hard to speak about vows and how to deal with all of these different situations because he had also made vows which he had to fulfill. And looking at what... Yeah, I'm not sure if I know how to respond exactly with all these situations of vows, but when it did come to her making a decision at that moment, she was able to forgive when it came to that specific instance. And so I'm not sure if I really know how to answer it much more. So that's the example that I was able to pull out, but somebody else can shed light. The acharyas right here.
Actually, if you see, Mahabharata speaks from the mostly dharmartha, kama, moksha and varanashram. Doesn't speak beyond the varanashram level, only the essence is presented in the Bhagavad, which is the Vaishnava dharma. So, Draupadi's compassion, this is what I've dealt in our classes, in the Mahabharata classes. Draupadi's compassion in this regard with Ashwatthama, precisely because he was a Brahmana son. So, because she was trained in the varanashram principle, she could never disobey the instructions of Varanashram Dharma. As a Kshatriya, even the Manusamhita mentions that even if a Brahmana performs abominable actions, because he's in that position, and she always had the respect to Dronacharya. So naturally, from the Varanashram point of view, she could make that hard decision to forgive Ashwatthama because he was a son of a Brahmana. But on the other hand, being a Kshatriya, she also had that right to take revenge against Dushyasana. That's what my understanding goes there. She had the right because if a Kshatriya performs some sinful activities, you have the right to take revenge as atatais, as the aggressors. But in regards to somebody who is from the Brahmana family, he cannot. And therefore, if you read the purport of Srila Prabhupada, Prabhupada does not agree with the compassion of Draupadi. He says, it may be nice to be compassionate, but still one should do the right thing. And therefore, he glorifies her compassion, but also in another purport he also says that, it may be nice to be compassionate, but one should always do the right thing. That's what my understanding. But the higher principle is taught by our acharyas. Of course, Draupadi is also acharya, but where there is no discrimination of whether you are from this varna or that varna, whatever, even yavanas were forgiven by Haridas Thakur. That is compassion or forgiving without seeing the background. So because the Varnashram Dharma was taught in India so strongly, then based upon which Varna would belong, then you would act accordingly. So even from that point of view, she is great. She knew, okay, this is what? So I cannot be acting like that. Because he is a son of one's teacher. So whatever he has done, even though the action of Ashwatthama was much severe than the action of Dushyasana, because Dushyasana simply, not even her body, her robes, but then because her Kshatriya blood came out with another Kshatriya, but then with a Brahmana, she acted as a Kshatriya again, because a Kshatriya always respects Brahmana. This is what my understanding in this context.
Govind Prabhu saved the day. Gantra Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.